we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatments of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, April 19th, 2019. I'm your host, Elise Jacobson, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator, Allison Cole.
Hi there.
This coming Monday, April 22nd, is Earth Day. It's a perfect time of year to put some extra thought and consideration into how we're treating our collective home and what we can all do to help leave a habitable planet for future generations of both humans and non-human animals. Our first interview coming up in about 15 minutes is with Lisa Papania, co-founder of Vancouver's own Loopy Community Cafe. Loopy is a zero-waste vegan community space that offers plant-based cooking classes and catering services, among other things. Dr. Papania will be telling us all about that and sharing tips on zero waste vegan living. And our feature interview today is with Denise Vallejo, a Los Angeles-based vegan chef and first generation Chicana who is the founder and owner of Alchemy Organica, a mobile ancestral kitchen inspired by the gastronomic heritage and plant wisdom of Mexico. She'll be speaking with us about the beautiful traditional Mexican dishes that she creates using only vegan ingredients and sharing her insights on how plant-based cooking and eating can be part of a praxis of decolonizing and creating a sustainable future for our planet. That's coming up in just over half an hour, so stay tuned. But first, Allison, you had some thoughts to share with us.
Yes, it's Easter weekend. Did you know that? It's something that sort of slipped my mind a little bit until a few days ago, and then I said, oh, we should talk about Easter during the show.
Right.
And, you know, things are going on in my head, and I was thinking, what do I want to talk about? Easter comes every year, and it's usually something that we cover on the show because the Easter traditional holiday involves a lot of animal exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And what better way to learn about, say, parts of these industries by listening to this video that I wanted to share with you and everyone out there listening. You haven't heard it yet. This is a story called Penny's Story, and it's about the Canadian egg industry. It was put out by Animal Justice, the national organization, which is a group of lawyers that looks out for animals, and they produced this film, and they are the main person in it is Jeff Regier, a friend of ours who has rescued some chickens from some very desperate situations in the egg industry, and our friend Anna Pippis from Animal Justice is in this short clip as well. So I'm going to just play a bit of it here, and then we shall discuss.
Cool.
So I know parents aren't supposed to have favorites, but Penny is without doubt my favorite. She's just so adorable. She's sensitive and sweet. She's incredible. Like, she knows her own name. She comes when I call her name specifically.
Come here, Penny. Penny, come here.
I don't speak chicken perfectly, but you can tell when she wants something from you. She makes just the short notes. It's kind of like she's just saying the word what. So it's kind of like, what?
You ready for bed, Penny? Come on.
Unlike the other hens that spend the night in the shed, Penny comes in and she sleeps in my bedroom every night. When it's morning, or usually around 7, 7:30, she'll start peeping, she'll hop on the bed, and basically just telling me that, hey, I'm ready to come out to go outside now. And so I'll let her outside, and then she'll do her chicken thing. She'll be a chicken during the day and explore the yard, scratch in the dirt, dust bathe, preen. She's running in the yard, and 90% of her feathers have come back. I mean, she looks incredible versus the way she looked when she first came.
On April 23rd, Jeff and other eyewitnesses visited an egg farm in Abbotsford. Dozens were rescued.
When I found her, she was in the manure pit, really unable to stand, like so weak. Who knows how long she had been down there and just left to drown in her own excrement or die of thirst and starvation. When the vet first saw the chickens, she was horrified at their condition. And this is a letter she wrote. The initial presentation of these chickens at our hospital was disappointing and disturbing. The group in general were dull, weak, dehydrated, some with overt fractures, skin wounds. Some were dead and some dying. The transformation of these hens has been incredible. They were scrawny and emaciated and weak, and now they're strong, they're vibrant, they're healthy, and you can see the lust they have for life. They're excited to come out of the shed every morning and explore the garden. The difference is a fortunate, but at the same time, cruel dichotomy, because there must have been so many others that were never or never will be rescued. The life of a modern-day egg-laying hen is so horrific.
In Canada, over 20 million hens are exploited for their eggs annually in conditions like these.
Imagine getting trapped in an elevator with an elevator full of strangers. And imagine if you got trapped in that elevator for a year and a half. No family, no natural lighting, no windows. Don't get to choose who you spend your time with. If you don't get along with them, too bad. If they pick a fight with you, too bad. You can't bathe, you can't get clean, you can't go outside, you can't do anything at all. And at the end of this year and a half, imagine if you were grabbed upside down by your leg by a captor who didn't see you and didn't register your pain and suffering, and ultimately you were killed and eaten. That is the life of an egg-laying hen in Canada.
As soon as you enter any of these egg barns, you're immediately overwhelmed by the powerful stench of ammonia. It's so strong it makes your eyes water. Turn a flashlight on and you can see the air is just full of particulate matter that you cannot help but breathe in. You look down the rows upon rows of cages and you see all of these individuals packed into wire cages the size of a filing cabinet drawer, with anywhere from 5 to 10 birds in each cage. And if you go down below into the manure pit, I saw birds dead and dying there as well.
In hatcheries, they're hatched into a tray, and the first thing that they know is being separated. The female chicks, of course, will go on to become the laying hens, but the male chicks have no use. They can't be used for meat chickens because they're bred for different purposes, and so they'll be killed immediately upon hatching, which is typically in a large industrial macerator. Think of a large blender, and that's pretty much what a macerator is. Chickens are incredible mothers. It's unimaginable to think that they don't know their babies or that their babies don't have the warmth and comfort of their mothers.
So we'll stop right there. And neither you, Elise, or you, Sinead, had seen this film before. I was really surprised. So that's a preview. That's the first 4 minutes. What did you think?
That was very compelling. I thought they did a beautiful job.
Yeah, and when you see the images, you'll know even more. And I'll repost. I have posted this on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. I'll repost it on there when it come later today. And yeah, you know, that this video struck me because eggs are such a large part of Easter, and some information here says that that eggs are in the U.S. alone during the Easter season, over 180 million eggs will be purchased.
Wow.
And that's because they're being used for children's activities, like dyeing eggs or having an Easter egg hunt. But the worst thing that you could do for animals is to support the egg industry. As it also mentioned in this film, this is always the number one reason why I tell people I don't eat eggs, is because all the day-old male chicks, which is 50% of who is laid that day, they all get thrown in a macerator or they get suffocated to death. I also posted that on my personal Facebook, I think yesterday, a real video of someone finding all of these chicks, day-old chicks, some still in the shells, just piled and piled into dumpsters and suffocated.
Yeah, that's terrible.
So, yeah, so, you know, Easter is a season of tradition. It's actually based on a Christian holiday. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people just have sort of transformed it into a pagan holiday where it's all about Easter egg hunts and fluffy bunnies and baby chicks who you really shouldn't purchase for your children, because the majority of baby animals purchased as Easter surprises end up dead or abandoned because people are not in the position to actually take care of these animals. A bunny is a 10-year commitment. Mm-hmm. Did you know that? And 95% of them end up straight away in shelters or abandoned. Mm-hmm. I've seen bunnies abandoned.
Exactly.
So just one more quick thing about celebrating a traditional Easter, but also changing traditions, because I think that's something that we can do, and it has been done. what do you two suggest in terms of, I don't know how you celebrate Easter, but even just the options that are out there for eating an Easter meal?
I don't really celebrate Easter myself, but I think there are a lot of options. There's a lot of, you know, vegan Easter chocolate available. There's, you know, you can dye wooden eggs or paper mache eggs instead of actual chicken's eggs, and they look exactly the same. They're just as beautiful. And, you know, even, there's, you know, Easter ham roasts available now that are completely animal-free. Like, there's all these beautiful replacements. So.
Right. So when celebrating Easter this year, please think of having a compassionate Easter.
Exactly.
And we have some news now with Sinead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of bunnies, nearly 10 months after it was passed by the Senate, a bill that would ban cosmetic testing on animals in Canada has started its journey through the House of Commons as of last week. So the Cruelty-Free Cosmetics Act was first introduced in December 2015, and it would prohibit cosmetics testing on animals in Canada. It would also amend the Food and Drugs Act to ban the sale of cosmetics developed or manufactured through the use of animal testing. So if it's passed, this bill would make Canada the world's 40th country to prohibit cosmetic testing on animals. The EU, India, New Zealand, Taiwan, South Korea, Guatemala, and most recently Australia are among other places that have banned it. And yeah, you know, it's just so, it's such an obvious thing, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, why would you subject an animal to that kind of torture for stuff that is so obviously unnecessary?
Mm-hmm.
And actually last year, the largest petition in nearly 70 years to land on Parliament Hill contained almost 650,000 signatures from Canadians across the country calling for an end to cosmetic testing. So it has really strong support, but due to the nature of the system of government, moving the bill along through the House has been more complicated than anybody anticipates. And with the end of session fast approaching and an election coming in the fall, there's not a lot of time left for the bill to work its way through the House. So we need people to voice their support for Bill S-214, the Cruelty-Free Cosmetics Act. And Animal Justice has made this easy. You can send a letter to your MP through their website, animaljustice.ca, and do something to help the bunnies and everyone else in the labs. Speaking of religion and animals, this news comes from The Ecologist. The major global campaign, Million Dollar Vegan, which asked Pope Francis to try a plant-based diet for Lent, has given $100,000 to the vegan humanitarian aid organization Chili's on Wheels to help survivors of Hurricane Maria. Million Dollar Vegan originally offered $1 million to a charity of Pope Francis's choice if he accepted the challenge to go vegan for Lent. The campaign was fronted by 12-year-old activist Genesis Butler, who we've had on the show before, and she's amazing. And she wrote to Pope Francis in a letter that was published in major newspapers all over the world. And she visited the Vatican, where she hoped to meet him and ask him to fight climate change with diet change. So he did not do that, but just since they had raised all this money, they've donated the money instead to Chili's on Wheels in Puerto Rico, which is providing food relief to survivors of 2017's Hurricane Maria, and they're also there. They've set up a permanent community center in San Juan. They're continuing to serve vegan food to vulnerable people and hold workshops, training, and everything. And it's really, really great stuff. And hurricanes and extreme weather events are increasing due to human-induced climate change. And animal agriculture has a greater impact on global warming than the fuel emissions from the entire global transport sector combined. And it's a leading driver of deforestation, biodiversity loss, and causes suffering to billions of farmed animals. So these are all reasons why Million Dollar Vegan asked Pope Francis to fight climate change with diet change. And even if he declined, all you listeners can do something today to help the climate by opting for plant-based foods.
Yeah, and check out the interview that we did with Genesis about this. It's on our page, animalvoices.org. You can find it on our March 15th show. That was our feature interview.
Right. Thank you so much. So my first guest today is Dr. Lisa Papania, a professor at the Beattie School of Business at Simon Fraser University and co-founder of Loopy Community Cafe, a zero-waste vegan community space in East Vancouver. Hello, Lisa, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, Ellie. Thank you so much for having me today.
For sure. Thank you for being here. So tell us about Loopy Cafe. What is your mission and what kind of work do you do?
So Loopy Cafe emerged out of my entire adult research dream and passions over almost two decades now. It has a long history. I hope you don't mind me going back in time a little bit. But I teach at the business school at SFU, and I teach entrepreneurship and innovation. That's actually my field, and I've been working in the area of sustainability for close to 20 years as well. But when you teach entrepreneurship and innovation, you obviously, you're ideally supposed to be looking at, you know, what's broken in the world as a kind of an opportunity to intervene. And that's really what we should be doing, looking at things that are broken in order to be able to fix them. The world has changed over the last 40 years. I know it's been more than that, where we stopped actually trying to solve problems and we just make technology gadgets, and they've actually made the world way worse. But as an entrepreneur and as an innovation professor, I've been looking at, you know, what's wrong and where the opportunities are to fix things. And over the last two decades, as I've been doing my research, although there are lots of opportunities for fixing the system, which should be exciting, it's actually unbelievably depressing to see how many things are wrong. And as I looked around, and as I got my students to look around at all of the things that provided these opportunities for intervention and entrepreneurship, the more and more sad and depressed and terrified I got. And so I would ask my students to come up with new ideas for businesses that were good. And over the course of many years, I'd point to organizations that aren't doing very good things, and I would say, you know, not like that. And they used to come back to me and say, it's really not fair that I'm putting out these requirements to them of doing these businesses or creating businesses when there are no models in the world for them to look to. And I find that very, very depressing and sad. And so there was a space in my community that came available for the first time in 30 years. It was the video store. It was the community video store. I live in a very walkable neighborhood where there are lots of families and old people and just families. It's a very green space. And this video shop was a community space. And when it went up for rent for the first time in 30 years, I said, this is my opportunity. This is my opportunity to put my money where my mouth is, to practice what I preach, and to be the business that I keep telling my students that they have to be. So I can be that showcase. And also it was at this time in Vancouver where there were a whole bunch of different types of organizations that could have possibly decided that they were going to start there, and I didn't want to be the person that was picketing outside the cafe, outside whatever it became. I wanted to, instead of complaining, I wanted to do something. And so, at the end of 2014, I said to my husband, so I want to start a coffee shop. And I was really, really hoping he'd say, that's a ridiculous idea. He's like, no, that's fabulous. Let's do that. So, so that was like, oh my God, what did I just do? So I wanted to start. I wanted to be in my community. I wanted to practice the things that I was preaching. It wasn't the first entrepreneurial venture that we'd started, but it was, the first location that required us to have a physical space. Also, because I was asking my students to go and make things in the world, one of the things that they found most frustrating, especially as students, as poor students, when they were coming up with entrepreneurial ideas and I put them out there, they weren't getting anybody to support them, both financially, just with time and space and confidence. And so I also wanted to create a space where my students could come and launch their businesses. They could put stuff on the shelves, and they could have their first days, weeks, years without having to worry about having to cover the cost of shelf space and those kinds of things. So I just wanted to be able to be a place that gave other people a leg up and did things well. And so, yeah, so when we started as Loopy Cafe, I wanted to make I wanted to be an example of a good business. I wanted to have no waste. but not just at the end of the chain, not just at the end of the supply chain. Some of the research that I'd been doing over the years was not just about the plastic waste that comes as a result of all of the stuff that we buy, which is horrifying and devastating and destructive beyond measure. But my students and I had done all of this research about all of the waste that happens at the beginning of the supply chain, and not just how much money is wasted. And it's an insane amount of money that is wasted when organizations produce too much. And that's a requirement of our capitalist system, is that we just overproduce and overproduce. We're on a treadmill of overproduction. Overproduction, requiring more overproduction to try to cover the costs of previous overproduction and the waste that incurs, and the human waste and the social waste, and you know, we devastate people's salaries and we devastate land and we abuse animals beyond belief and all of these kinds of things. And so I wanted to be able to put into the world an organization that didn't do that, that didn't require that destructive system, that shone a light on the destruction that was happening at the beginning of the supply chain all over the world, that chose and explicitly made public the choices that we were making that were better for the environment, for people, for the planet, all the way through, and for our community more than anything. And one of the things that that was really important, very important from the very beginning of Loopy Cafe, was that Loopy was for the community, and it's actually one of the biggest things that's saddened me the most, is how people haven't really figured out how to understand that. Because fundamentally, we were for the community. Even before we started, before we actually opened as a cafe, we would hold community dinners, and I would take food for the entire community to the community center for about like 200 people. I think the original community dinners that I catered for was about, I think we had 270 the first community dinner that we held, and it was just phenomenal. It was the first time that people were saying that the community had just come together and just like sat down and had a meal together. And we would do that monthly at no cost, and people would become more and more suspicious. Why are you doing this? Why? It was very strange that there was so much suspicion. But that was really what we wanted to do. We wanted to be by and for the community first. We wanted to be a place where people could come together, because we truly believe, I don't know whether this is our mission, but this is really our fundamental philosophy, is that if you want to make change in the world, you have to give first. I mean, it's a logic problem. It's not a religious thing. You were talking about religion earlier. It's not a religious thing. It's not given, ye shall receive. It's not a religious thing. It's a logic thing. If everybody sits in a circle and we all give to the next person in the circle, everybody gets. But if we all sit in that circle and we go, and you hold on to what you have and you go, I'm not going to give until I get, then nobody gets anything. And so as Loopy Cafe, we wanted to be that space in the community that gave first. And that was what we had been doing since 2015 when we opened. Basically, we were essentially a charity where we would we gave away free produce every month, every week, sorry. We would give away free food. We had put on these community dinners that changed over time to be something that we gave free food every day. And then as our business model was never really a business model. As our model shifted and we kind of ran out of money, we were able to give, we were able to give that mostly as free produce that we gave away on a regular basis, and we still heavily subsidized the catering that we do. But when we were speaking about this and we were giving food and we were trying to help people understand what food really looks like, because we've lost an idea of what actually food looks like or what it is, people would come to us and say, first of all, how do you do this? You know, how? They don't understand how financially you can give stuff away, and it's all about, and I think that one of the things about zero waste and veganism is just making choices. You know, I can buy a new car. I don't need a new car, or I can help my community. But people then didn't understand why. And I said, but if I help my community, that helps me. If I know that my neighbor has to make a decision between clothing their child and feeding their child in order for that child to be able to go to school, And I'm in a position, financially or whatever else, I'm in a position to be able to provide that child and that family with food, then that family no longer has to make a choice. That family then just has to clothe the child. I can feed the child. The child gets to go to school. The child gets to graduate. The child gets to go and get a job. The child gets to contribute to the community and become a member of a community that can advance the community, and then I benefit. And so, you know, if I'm in a position to do that, whereas if I said, no, I'm going to hold on to this money and I'm going to let that kid not eat or make the parent have to choose between feeding or clothing that kid, and that kid doesn't get to go to school, then suddenly my community is put at risk because of that. So if I'm in a position to help, I actually am the person that's going to benefit. And so people, we explain this over and over, but people really have a lot of trouble understanding what that is. And so that's really what we've tried to continue to do. And it's taken various forms over the last 4 years. But that's essentially what it is that we do. We try to be a space in the community and in Vancouver that first says, what is it that we need to do to be able to move our community and our society forward, and how can we take our skills, our capacity, our finances, our spare time, and do that in a way that we feel can contribute and can move the bar and make it easier for other people to do this stuff too. And I do need to very stress that we're definitely not by any stretch of the imagination the only people doing this work. There's hundreds and thousands of amazing people who are all pushing, you know, I heard somebody say that pushing a boulder up the hill. There are lots of people who have come before us and are working with us to push the boulder of community engagement and veganism and sustainability. They're all pushing the boulder up the hill. We're definitely not the only people. But we keep thinking the reason that we have to keep doing this is if we were that one extra person that was able to get then that boulder up the hill, and if we just walked away, that boulder would roll back down the hill, then, you know, then we've abandoned before we actually made any difference. So we keep at it. We keep doing it no matter how hard it is or how many bad decisions different provinces in Canada make as to who should lead them for the next provincial elections. We keep pushing that boulder up the hill so that that eventually, hopefully one day, we can all move to a more sustainable, equal, community-based society.
Thank you. Do you have any tips for vegans in our community who would like to transition to a zero waste lifestyle?
The thing that we try to teach and the thing that we try to preach, I think, the most is just think about everything. Just like, I think that the one thing that we've come to as a consumptive and consumer society is that we've outsourced all of our decision making to someone else, and I think we've got to stop that. Whoever that other person is, that other entity is, has been making decisions for us, has been making really bad decisions. And so for anybody who wants to just become vegan or just become more sustainable, just ask questions. Just don't take the things that we've been told for granted. Just ask questions. Say, where does this come from? Who is being disenfranchised? Who is being hurt by whatever it is I'm buying right now, and how do I make a choice instead that benefits people, not just benefits my wallet, but benefits the people who are involved in making this, benefits the planet, benefits the workers, make sure that nobody, no animals, no humans suffer in the making of that. That's what I would say. Just make choices that are informed.
Great. Well, unfortunately, I think that is all the time we have for today. But thank you so much for joining us today, Lisa, and telling us about the amazing work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me on the air.
For sure. We've been speaking with Dr. Lisa Papania, co-founder of Vancouver's own Loopy Community Cafe. Among other things, Loopy offers ethical catering services and a vegan zero-waste food professional course. If you'd like to learn more about this, visit loopycafe.com. That's loopiicafe.com.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. And now for some events. Next Sunday, April 28th, join for an Earth Day fundraiser at Bandita's Taqueria. They're
celebrating Earth Day a week late, as they note on their website. But it sounds like it's going to be a really good day. Banditas on Commercial Drive will be hosting a community fundraiser, student arts show, and sidewalk festival to celebrate Earth Day. 100% of the profits from the entire day's food and drink sales will be donated to Raven Trust, which is an organization that helps Indigenous communities fight for environmental protection by offsetting their legal costs. And specifically, this year's donations will be going to the Raven Trust Step Up for Coast Heroes campaign for the Helsic Nation. The Helsic Nation was one of the three heroes of the successful Enbridge Court Challenge, and they suffered a major oil spill in their territory near Bella Bella in October of 2016. So last fall, on the anniversary of that spill, they took Kirby Corporation and the federal government to court in a groundbreaking legal challenge that stands to set a precedent for Aboriginal title to the ocean, which is a world first. So in addition to a great cause and great food, there will also be a student art show featuring environmental-themed art pieces from six East Van elementary schools and a sidewalk festival outside the restaurant featuring a representative from Raven Trust, a plant sale by Victory Gardens to raise money for the classroom gardener, as well as live music provided by various local musicians, including me.
Yay!
Yeah. I was wondering when you were going to get to that.
No, they've started doing a bit of live music at Banditas, and they really just do their best to support local artists and communities in whatever ways they can, and I mean great food too. So again, this is Sunday, April 28th from 9 a.m. until midnight at Banditas Taqueria at 12th and Commercial Drive. You can find more information on their website at banditastaqueria.com. And on Thursday, May the 9th, the Ottawa International Vegan Film Festival comes to Vancouver. The Ottawa International Vegan Film Festival is a trailblazing event dedicated to celebrating the vegan ideal, a healthier, compassionate, environmentally friendly lifestyle that can be achieved through the consumption of plants and animal-free alternatives. So join us for a night of award-winning film viewing surrounding veganism, with vegan snacks available for purchase from Urban Leaf Plant-Based Foods and Eat the Dishes, beer and wine, and guest speakers Indian Rock Vegans, who are featured in one of the films being screened called Eating You Alive. So yeah, these are all films that were featured in the Ottawa Vegan Film Festival last fall, and now they've come to Vancouver to do this screening at the York Theatre to raise money for the Vancouver Vegan Festival, which takes place on July 27th at Creekside Park. So that's a separate event later this summer, but in order to keep that one free, they're doing this film festival just to raise some money, make it easy for everyone to come out to this big event in the summertime. And so the doors are at 6 p.m., screening is at 7, and the films featured include 73 Cows, which we've talked about on the show before. It's a short film featuring a beef farmer who wound up giving all his cattle to a sanctuary to live out their lives. So that's just one of several short films that will be screened at the York Theatre on this day. So again, that will be Thursday, May the 9th, 6 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at the York Theatre at 639 Commercial Drive. And if you have any animal-friendly events that you'd like us to share on the show, feel free to send us an email at info@animalvoices.org.
Thank you, Sinead. So my featured guest today is Denise Vallejo, a Los Angeles-based vegan chef and first-generation Chicana who is the founder and owner of Alchemy Organica, a mobile ancestral kitchen inspired by the gastronomic heritage and plant wisdom of Mexico. Hello, Denise, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
For sure. Thank you for being here. So first of all, I'd love to hear about your vegan journey. When did you go vegan and what compelled you to adopt this lifestyle?
I went vegan a little over 10 years ago, and I had to deal with my father having a stroke. At that time, I was already vegetarian. I'd been vegetarian for a few years. Really, it just took that, and also the passing of my aunt, you know, all these medical issues that were happening in my family. I just kind of, it hit me pretty hard, and I knew that food had a lot to do with it.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I'm sorry to hear that, but that's very compelling. Tell us about the work that you do with Alchemy Organica.
Basically, Alchemy Organica is serving to kind of revitalize the ancestral foodways. I experienced a lot of pushback when I first went vegetarian by my peers. A lot of Chicano exes were kind of criticizing me for giving up meat and cheese, and I just kind of felt like, well, you know, we really don't know that food, the way it used to be, was, you know, very plant-based, and, you know, the authenticity factor really doesn't really matter with meat, you know, meat and dairy and all these things are very colonial. So I just kind of felt like I needed to prove a point and say, well, you know, this is our real heritage. And so just being motivated by that, being motivated by also just really enjoying Mexican food and missing it, you know. So I wanted to have these foods available to the community, and also to help the community take back their own health as well. So really it's just a lot of that, reintroducing these foods to the community, and also wanting to kind of uplift the food in a way where it's presented in ways that I think can compare to a lot of food that is Eurocentric and tends to be regarded in high esteem. You know, we have like French cuisines and Italian foods that are everyone's favorite, and we have this perception of it being very valuable. But we think of Mexican food as very humble or peasant food and all of that, and I just kind of wanted to flip it on everyone.
Awesome. Yeah. So what sorts of events or other projects do you do with the company?
Mostly pop-up dining. There's fine dining events. There's street vending, keeping it casual for a lot of people, making it accessible to the community. Recently just started doing this event where it's centered around indigenous culture. I did a Mexica New Year out here in LA, and I really loved the feedback that I got. The community really embraced our food, so we just started, myself and a group of my friends, we all have different pop-ups centered around juices and pastries and things like that. So we recently did an event at a park, and it was just a little small event, but a lot of people came out, and it was great. There's people that want to get, you know, reconnected with their roots and their ancestry. So I just kind of want to continue that work.
Amazing. That sounds great. So who or what would you say have been your biggest influences, both in your cooking and your overall food philosophy?
I feel like my parents instilled a lot of philosophy with health. My mom in particular, she really always would cook with whole grains and you know, low fat, and she just always, and no sugary things. We didn't really grow up eating a lot of sugary food, so I kind of have a palate for that. And then the influence of my aunt that passed away, she was like a gourmand. She loved coming over to the house and making these amazing pasta dishes and things like that. So I think I just combined the two, and, you know, something that's, I guess, fancy, but also nutritionally, you know, sound.
Right. So you've stated that the meat-heavy cuisine that most people think of as Mexican food is actually heavily influenced by colonialism, and that traditional foodways in Mexico were more plant-based. Can you elaborate more on this?
Oh, yeah, sure. With colonialism, we were introduced to cattle and pork and things like that. So then there's, and then dairy. So these are all like high cholesterol foods when our ancestors were primarily just eating beans and squash and and corn, and we weren't putting manteca in tamales or anything like that. You know, everything was very plant-based. It really wasn't until the conquest that we were introduced to these foods and also made to give up a lot of our old foods. But there's still resilience in our culture, and there's still, you know, these foods are still here. We just have to remember them. You know, we have superfoods now that everyone's coming around to understanding, like spirulina and chia and amaranth and all of that. These are all old foods. They're not really new, but we're only now finding out about them. Quinoa, things like that, you know, they're becoming very trendy now, but these are all old foods.
Absolutely. I'm curious, how did you learn about these traditional foodways? Was this passed down, like, from your family, or you did your own research?
A little bit was. I would say it's about half and half. Most of it is just reading. And then when I started reading more and more about curanderismo, which is a type of, like, shamanism, plant medicine, you know, medicine women and stuff like that, I realized how much of that information I had learned through oral traditions, that these little traditions and these ways were already instilled in our family. And it was kind of cool to find out, like, oh, wow, my mom was already doing this, you know, as a kid, finding different herbs and for different little ailments that a child would have, like an earache. She would get ruda or rue and mix it with a little olive oil and put it in a cotton ball and stick it in my ear. And it was just this smelly plant, and I didn't understand what was going on, but it would fix my earache, you know. And then as I got more and more interested in these curanderismo studies, I just started seeing the patterns, like, oh, wow, our family really already did this. These are traditions that get passed down, and we don't really think about it. It's just integrated into the culture.
Wow, cool. So in your view, how can plant-based cooking and eating be part of a praxis of decolonizing?
Well, I think it's just a matter of, you know, revitalizing the foodways. We're taking our health back in mind. Our culture is so important, and I think we have trouble understanding how valuable our culture is, because we were meant, we experienced a lot of, basically genocide, right? Like, our people were demonized for a lot of our ways, and so just taking back this power, taking back this culture is going to reconnect us to the earth, and decolonizing is just so important for us to feel empowered again as people.
Yeah, that's amazing. So we hear a lot in the media these days about how adopting a plant-based diet can slash a person's impact on the planet, which is great. We've covered this a lot on Animal Voices. So how can taking cues from indigenous culinary traditions further help to achieve environmental justice and sustainability?
It's built into the culture. Our ancestors were keepers. They kept the land. They were caretakers of the land. So as we begin to integrate more of this culture, more of our understanding of the medicinal value of plants, the spirit, even respecting animals and the way we would use animals in ancestral ways, it just grounds us. It connects us back to earth, and I think we'll end up having a little more respect and more of a connection to the earth, and therefore making better decisions and creating more sustainable ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So I haven't had the privilege of trying any of your creations yet. I hope to someday. But I have seen photos of them online. They look absolutely beautiful, colorful, fresh, very appealing. Can you describe some of the dishes that you make for our listeners?
Sure. I think one of my favorite dishes recently was a pozole verde. This dish is similar to like a red pozole, but the broth is made with a lot of ancestral herbs like epazote and watercress, which are considered quelites, or like wild greens. And then it gets blended with pumpkin seeds and chilies and tomatillos. So it's just this very vibrant, verdant, herbaceous broth, and really creamy. And I mix in different different kinds of mushrooms and things like that. So it's just very flavorful and very satisfying and sort of heartwarming.
Awesome. Yeah. Can you describe any of the other dishes that you make?
Yeah. The other really popular dish I've noticed is these croquetas or croquettes that I make out of wasamble. I really like this dish because it's utilizing wasambles, which are this is an ancestral plant. It's also a wild green, and oftentimes people treat it like a weed. It can be growing in someone's backyard, and we just hack it down, but it's so rich in protein, and I end up battering that in this cornflake batter, and it's stuffed with cheese, and I serve it with this tomato sauce, and it's just this flavorful, gooey, melty, cheesy, I don't know how to explain it, but crispy, and it's sort of the flavor profile is sort of like a combination of spinach and broccoli, so it's like an ancestral spinach, and it's just really enjoyable, because who doesn't love fried food, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it sounds amazing. I'm getting hungry. Yeah, I saw on your Facebook or something, actually, you make your own cheese, is that right?
Yeah, and people really like it, so I'm actually thinking about making it for retail.
Wow. It's made out of nuts, or what do you use?
Cashews. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's made out of cashews.
Oh, lovely. So so far, what has the response been like from your community to these dishes?
It's been pretty good. I set up here locally in Koreatown in L.A., and this, in particular, this area is mostly Central American indigenous, and at first, when I tell people, you know, oh, everything is vegan, there's no meat here, they're a little reluctant, but, you know, I'll give away a sample, I'll give away a taco, and then their eyes light up, and they're like, wow, and this is all organic, and there's no cholesterol, and then they just start telling their family members. It's gotten to a point now when we set up, you know, the locals walk by and they're like, oh, here come the organic tacos, you know. So wow. We're just kind of developing a little bit of a reputation here, and it's really surprising. But I love it. Now I'm starting to see more of my neighbors come out, and it's really cool to be able to connect with people that otherwise wouldn't think of eating vegan, or at least they don't know that they're eating vegan.
That's so cool. So what's next for you? Do you have any exciting events coming up?
Just probably building more on that plant-based indigenous cultural event that we did. It's called Kuali Tonali, which is Nahuatl for a good day. And so we really want to expand on that, my friends and I. We think if we can find a larger venue, we can get more vendors involved and just really make it a culturally significant event.
Beautiful. Well, oh, Sinead, did you have a question? Co-hosts are looking at me. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us on Animal Voices today, Denise, and for sharing your experience and insights with us.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Denise Vallejo, founder and executive chef of Alchemy Organica. If you'd like to learn more about her work, visit alchemyorganica.com and check out Alchemy Organica on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Join us next Friday, April 26th at noon. Allison?
Yeah, I want to talk about what's going on in next week's show. So I don't know if both of you know, but I was in Toronto for a day and a half last week.
Right.
Okay, so.
A day and a half. Oh, that's
yeah,
a quick trip.
A day and a half. Very quick. A lot of action.
Yeah.
A lot of food, a lot of activist action. I met this amazing activist community who are so passionate about doing what they do, which is basically educating the public, outreach. And you can see a video of me on our Facebook page that Jenny McQueen took. We've had Jenny McQueen on our show recently. She's involved with what is known as hashtag Pig Trial 2. The Pig Trial 1 was when, remember, Anita Crines was charged with mischief for feeding water to pigs, and that was thrown out. Mm-hmm. So a new pig trial now is with Jenny McQueen. Over a year ago, she went into a pig farm locally, and she documented the horrors and the cruelties that were happening in these places. And if you want to know anything about this, you can go to their webpage, DXC Toronto Facebook page, I could say, and that is, that information is there. So since then, we've had Jenny on the show in December, I believe, to explain what's happening with her court case now, because she's been charged with theft because she rescued a baby pig. Wow. Baby piglet. The cutest baby piglet I've ever seen, by the way. And yeah, and so what happens now? So when I was, the week that I was in Ontario last week, she had a trial date in London, Ontario, I believe, because that was the closest place as to where this incident happened. And CTV was out there and did an interview, which was good. They got that on the mainstream news. And basically what happened is nothing happened at that court trial. They have rebooked a date for May the 1st. So now Jenny McQueen will be going to court. They didn't have enough evidence or something that they needed that day, but there were a lot of activists out there supporting her, and she has a really well-spoken lawyer who spoke to CTV as well, and I'm glad that it made some news, so good for her. Yeah. And then she was very active this whole day. We started off in the daytime with a DXC disruption event that I took part in with Jenny and a bunch of local people, including Darren Chang, one of our past co-hosts. He's in the group with them now. He lives in Toronto. And we disrupted a Sobeys, and that was actually in protest of a Dare's Pork, which is sold there. If you want to hear more about that, there is a live Facebook video that is posted on our page. That was posted last weekend when I did this. I was right behind Jenny, so you see the back of my head and the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
You'll recognize it's me.
Right.
I'm wearing the same scarf that I'm wearing right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So that was fun. And then after that, there was a Cube of Truth that was being held at the Ripley's Aquarium, also mm-hmm. in conjunction of the World Day to End Fishing, which was supposed to have been, I think, a week or two before, but they got rained out. And yeah, there was a Raptors game coming out at that time, right next door. Like, the Ripley's Aquarium is right next door to the big arena that would be it's the Staples Arena, I think. It's the equivalent of our Rogers Arena. And there was a game getting out, and then there was also a Blue Jays game getting out somewhere, so a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
And I was simply looking for a bathroom, and I went into the Ripley's Aquarium and saw a very sad sight there. I'm going to share that video that I took of just these beautiful fish that were in this aquarium, not very big, about the size of my, maybe about 7-8 feet in diameter, and just there on display, and beautiful tropical fish. It's so sad that they have to have a life living in an aquarium like that. But anyways, I left that place pretty quickly, and yeah, the group was just so great. I'm in the photo for the Cube, but I didn't even take part in it because I was charging my cell phone. But after that, we went to an ethical butcher. Is there such thing as an ethical butcher?
Quote unquote ethical butcher. Yeah.
Yeah. You can look them up. So on next week's show, this is where I'm getting to. Next week's show is themed all about Vegan Toronto, about my day and a half packed time there with some amazing vegan food and many passionate vegan activists. So our feature interview, I'm thrilled to have award-winning chef Doug McNish on the show. He has recently opened the popular diner called the Mythology Diner in Toronto, which showcases mind-blowing, authentic comfort food and dishes. And he'll be speaking with us about his food making principles and about how he combines vegan animal activists into his business. So imagine that. We don't have a lot of that being promoted in vegan businesses here in Vancouver, where he actually has a card that says something like, "You're not an animal lover if you eat animals." I was so inspired and impressed, and I said, I want to have him on the show also because I know him as this amazing raw chef, and he went from raw to this cooked comfort food, and he makes his pastrami from scratch and his cheeses from scratch. I had this popular Reuben sandwich there and an amazing Nutella cheesecake. So I had some good eats in Toronto. And also, we'll have an interview with Toronto activist Marnie Ugar, who is the co-leader of the local group called Grass Toronto. So she'll be telling us about the actions that her group is doing these days, which involves doing weekly protests at this ethical butcher that I went to called Cumbrae's. It's on Queen Street West in downtown Toronto. And they convey a message of raising ethical meat that isn't, you know, happily slaughtered, whatever. Right. So we'll be talking more about that, and I certainly do look forward to that. So that's on next week's show. Tune in.
Right. Thank you, Allison. Yeah, again, that's next Friday, April 26th at noon, right here on 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Visit our website, animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows and download them as podcasts. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links and subscribe to us on iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver and on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And now we'll leave you with a song. This is Marvin Gaye's classic plea for environmental justice, Mercy, Mercy Me. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Things ain't what they used to do. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby our lives. Mercy, mercy me. Mercy, all things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand that?